Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay. Hello.
So thank you for joining us.
Welcome back to another episode of
Untalented by Unknown. That was one of the weirdest beginnings of a podcast. Alex Beck, co-founder of It's Nice That. I'm really excited to have you here. And I want to kind of set the scene for people that don't know you. Before I give these headlines, right, because we've got big headlines here, like you started a blog and you grew it from nothing to having an 8.5 million person reach every single month. It's nice that has now become this globally recognized media business after running it for beyond 10 years. You built three businesses, you've sold them to residents. You're building a thing that I think is just fucking phenomenal, which we will get onto. But I just wanted to pause for a moment and just say, I think you are one of the only CEOs, founders that I've ever met in my life that has run a business with such strong values and spirit and yet still remains so commercially smart and switched on. And I don't normally do this, but like it is really rare. And I really hope that at the end of this podcast, anyone that is thinking about starting a business, which is a different cohort of listeners, if they could take one thing from listening to you, it's this. You can be commercially successful and kind at the same time. So I don't normally do this at the beginning. I want to say thank you for being that person, which is just incredible. There's a key thing we want to speak about today, right? We could speak about all the things you've done with It's Nice That. We could speak about the audiences that you've reached and all the incredible designers and humans that you know and represent. But today the focus is much more around creative lives in progress, which I'm going to get you to explain in a moment. Before we get into that, though, and before we speak about junior talent access in the industry and what the world needs to do to make that improve, you have a talent. You have an unknown talent that you're going to be showing us today. And for the listeners who aren't watching right now, firstly, join and subscribe to our YouTube. Alex has a piece of paper balanced on his lap. Alex, welcome, and what the hell is that?
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Yeah, I feel like we don't need to do this now. You've done a better job. Well, this isn't a talent, actually.
Okay.
I was told I could, it could be a talent, or it could be a rant, or it could be a point of view, or something that kind of like, you know, eases everyone into getting to know me. So
exactly.
I bought a passage from a book. Okay. I'm not a big reader. My mum sent it to me, I'll be honest. But it's from a book about a psychiatrist, basically. It's called You Don't Have to Be Mad to Work Here, but it's all about psychiatry in the NHS. But stick with me here.
Okay.
So essentially, I guess my rant or my point of view is that this, you know, the goals that we are setting for ourselves and the, you know, comparisons we're making to all these other people is that it's all a complete madness. Like, yeah, what we're trying to strive for and achieve is truly impossible. So anyway, here we go.
Oh, wow.
So this is about, so they asked the psychiatrist, what's the secret to happiness? Mm-hmm. Okay. And he says, it's very simple. I want to say all you need is a healthy birth, secure attachment, happy childhood, minimal or no trauma, high resilience to stress, loving friends, family, partner, fulfilling work, financial security, manageable targets, 8 hours sleep a night, regular exercise, healthy diet, access to nature, limited use of alcohol, drugs and social media, faith, spirituality and acceptance of failure and death, an ability to process grief, a naturally positive outlook, maybe a pet, a gratitude journal, plus or minus antidepressants, therapy and 100% charge on your phone. It's easy, isn't it? And so I guess my point is that I feel like, and lots of podcasts I listen to or lots of the things that I read, I think you can fall into this trap of going, all of that stuff is attainable. Mm. And when you see it written out, this is the advice we're getting every day.
Yeah.
I just feel like we aren't setting ourselves, we're setting our, you know, success for everyone is being, you know, is being set by other people's standards.
Mm.
These are not all things I care about. These are not all things that I'm happy about. And so I think my call today, really, or what I think about a lot, is us being conscious about what it is we actually want,
yeah,
rather than trying to get through that list that you're never going to get to.
Wow. Do you know what's funny about that? And just tapping onto what you just said, like some of that stuff is really attainable.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it really does matter, but all of it in under one roof is impossible, right? I kind of like that to, like, even when companies pick values and stuff, or like when you say, I care about these things. Remember, like, post-COVID, everyone had to care about everything, whether it was like your mental health, whether it was DE&I, whether it was like everything became a priority. Mm-hmm. And you weren't allowed to say, I care about this one more mm-hmm. than that one. Mm-hmm. You had to say, I care about mm-hmm. all of them. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like that's reflective, yeah, of the stuff that you've just spoken about, mm-hmm. getting 8 hours sleep, isn't going to be possible if you prioritize being an entrepreneur mm-hmm. or, you know, prioritize being a really good parent.
I think it's just, I don't know, these are just unattainable things as a group. Do you know what I mean? I think when I was 18, my uncle gave me this sheet of paper and it had rules for life, and most of them are stupid. I've spoken about this loads of times. You know, it's like, you know, don't eat long food or something. I think he was stoned. I don't know what he was doing. But anyway, one of them was be good, but know what good is. And I've lived by that. Mm. Right. So my good is different to your good, is different to someone else's good, is different to, you know, that person you see on Instagram's good. Yeah. My good isn't having that body or isn't being owning an island or having a private jet or whatever else. My good is different to that. And that's fine.
Yeah.
You've got to be conscious of what your good is. Otherwise, you can start building a life or a career or desires that you don't actually want. It's very easy to get unconscious about what it is you even want or what success looks like. And I think that what we've always tried to do business-wise, but also personally, is just try and understand what good is to us and then go for that and not go for what good is to, I don't know, a competitor or something else.
How do you understand what good is to you? Is that like, be practical here. Like, is that literally me writing out a list of things that I really care about? Or is it from learned experience where you're figuring it out throughout your teens and 20s and you go, okay, right, I now know. Are you waiting for a moment, a sign, or?
I think it's a bit of both. I think one of the great things Will and I, the co-founder, did very early on was we wrote down what fulfilling potential looked like. What was success in this business? Mm. Like, what was success for It's Nice? And at that point it was, you know, maybe if we'd have done that right at the beginning, it was have 100 people look at it. Now it might be to, you know, grow in America or grow in Asia or something completely different.
Yeah.
But essentially, I think the key is to kind of appreciate what that thing is and constantly reflect on it, because that changes, right?
That's the important thing, transience.
But if you don't set the goals, then when you achieve them, there's nothing to celebrate. And you go straight on to the next thing. It's like, unless we facilitate, you know, some markers in our lives about when are you going to celebrate something or be sad about something?
Yeah.
I think you could just go on forever. It's a constant. We always did this thing, and we still do it at work. At the end of every year, we have like an annual, we call it the AGM, but just an annual celebration where people all talk about their biggest achievements that year and the things that went right, the things that didn't go so good. And you can draw a line. Otherwise, you're always referring back to it.
Yeah.
It's like, actually, it's done now. You've got to move on to the next thing. And I think that, I don't know, I'm a big believer at setting markers of success. And making them your own and making sure they're yours. And that might be, I don't know, it could be anything. It could be going to the park every day. It doesn't need to be a big, you know, double-digit growth or whatever else. And I think that there's just so much media telling you that you should be living your life like these people you see that you probably would hate.
If you spent the day.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
I love that. I'm going to center us because that is a world I could speak about for a very long time. Three stats for you, my friend. So I have done some research here. Now, you can tell me if these stats aren't real, but I've heard these across three different podcasts, so they must be. number one, 75% of Gen Z wants to work in the creative industry. Okay, no disputing?
No, I have no idea.
Fine.
Maybe.
Stat number two. In 2030, the global GDP is going to be made up of by 10% of the creative, of that 10% is the creative industry. Mm-hmm. I've got to think of a different way to say that. Mm-hmm. 10% of the global GDP will be the creative industry, which will be an uptick of 5%, which is where it currently is. Essentially, it's going to double in its size GDP contribution. Stat number three, and here comes the sad part, because currently I'm hearing, whoa, all the talent's heading into the creative economy. The economy is going to grow. And then there's this clangor of a stat, which is 60% of leaders say they would prefer to hire an AI agent than somebody in Gen Z. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to use that as a frame, because I'm hearing there's GDP growth in the creative economy. There's a desire to work in the creative economy. And yet somehow there is a lack of desire to bring those people in, and there's more of a desire to use robots instead of younger humans. What the fuck is going on?
It's a great question. I think we're in a time, AI could be very exciting for junior talent. Mm. I believe that, you know, I have an abundant mindset. I believe there's going to be enough for everyone. And, you know, maybe that's super naive, but I think that's a better way to wake up every morning and try and do something about it. So, you know, if you'd have told me in 2007 when we started, it's nice that, you know, we would have as many people working on social media as we did on editorial. Mm. I would have laughed because our social media strategy was adding people on MySpace.
Yeah.
And now it's not that. And so I think that that's quite interesting. So essentially jobs have been created in the most, you know, in the most fundamental way by that new technology of the internet, right?
Yeah.
And this has been said a million times. But my hope is that AI will create lots of new opportunity, both for juniors and for everyone in the industry. That has to be our hope and our understanding. But when you look at it right now, we're right at the beginning, right? So early. No one really knows what the real power of this is going to be. We've got a load of hunches. A load of people are making predictions about what things will be in 2030. I mean, tell me if you could work out what 25 was going to look like in 2020. I don't know. That's hard, right? And if we all had that crystal ball, you wouldn't be saying it here on a podcast.
No.
But I think the challenge is that right now, in my eyes, and if, you know, you kind of dumb it down to the lowest common denominator, AI equals efficiency, equals more EBIT, equals good. Right? It's quite a linear thing, right? And actually the way businesses are looking at it is this is a cost-saving measure. Mm-hmm. It's great for efficiency. And why is efficiency great? Because we make more money, correct?
Yeah.
That's kind of it. That's kind of why you might do the AI. It's an efficiency play right now. And sometimes it does that thing better. Let's also be honest about that, you know, write the notes from a meeting or whatever else. So that's where we're at. And that's very exciting. And that's very beguiling because it's like, wow, I can do all this stuff for less. But then the way I think about it is efficiency always exactly the right thing to do? So if you were to go back however many years, and I don't have, you know, a great historic knowledge of this company, but, you know, a footwear manufacturer might have used sweatshops and child labor at one point to make things more cheaply, more efficiently. You got make more EBIT and you go equals good. No.
Yeah.
At that point. Yeah. Well, no one's going to find out. We'll be fine. Right. Morally, there's a challenge there, of course. But how does that end up? Eventually, we get to understand the cost of efficiency. We get to understand the cost of doing it a certain way. And there may not be one, or there may be one with AI. I'd say there may be a cost, a human cost, to more EBIT for companies that we might have to correct. You know, like you could fly around the world on your private jet the whole time. And that might have a repercussion for the climate.
Yeah.
So now there's a real understanding of that. Was there an understanding of that at the beginning of air travel? Probably not. So I just think that there will be a increased developed understanding of the repercussions of AI tools and using it for certain things and generative image making, all those kind of things. There will, right now it's beguiling and it's exciting, and I'm excited to learn it as much as everyone else. And I would, you know, all those people we reach every month, I'd be saying learn it and get familiar with it and get excited by it. You know, see the possibilities, don't just see the downside. But my hunch is that there will be bigger moral implications, bigger social implications than we know. One might be mass unemployment at a junior level. One might be, I don't know, there could be millions of things that happen that socially that you go, oh, maybe I don't want to do it that way. Maybe I don't want it to be more efficient and cheaper. I actually want it to be done in a certain other way. The other thing I've tried to relate this to in my head, and these are just my thoughts, do you know what I mean? I'm sure millions of people would disagree with me, but the power and the excitement for me of AI is the democratization of it.
Yeah.
So the other thing I relate it to is like food production, right? So you can now probably go to the end of the road here and buy a loaf of bread for 30p, 50p, which is full of additives. It's full of rubbish stuff for you, but it lasts forever. And if you don't have the means, you're not privileged enough to be able to buy, you know, something else, you can have access to food. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
AI is the same. You can't get access to that design. I can't make that flyer for my restaurant, my local restaurant. Great. Now you do. That could be a really great thing. And there are great advantages to that. But if you have the means and you have the privilege and opportunity to choose, do you choose the organic, locally made loaf? Because you can, and it tastes nicer, and it's maybe better for your body. Do you choose that, or do you still choose the 50p I can stick in my freezer and it'll last for 2 months? That's a decision we made, and we do have the choice if you're lucky enough to have the means. And so that's how I see it. It's like, great, there might be a new 50p loaf, which will be wicked for so many people, and let's embrace that. But if we have the choice, big companies, massive agencies, massive brands, hiring all these swathes of people, if you have a choice, maybe there's something beyond the EBIT margin at the end of the day that might be more important.
I really agree, because at the end of the day, we're primarily engineered to, it's like status, right? We are these kind of apes that are competitive by nature. And the way I think about it is like, okay, if there is a premium option, just like airline travel or whatever, like, again, you could use airline travel to say, well, why does first class and business class, I think that they're selling more of those tickets than they ever have done, right? Why is that the case if everyone can just use economy? You're right. I think people will always want, at the end of the day, if it's about reaching eyeballs and it's about standing out, if we're talking about working at an advertising agency or a design company where your job is to make distinctive work that makes somebody stop scrolling or buy something, all that will happen is it will level and the volume will go up because everyone can make more stuff, and the general kind of mediocrity will just enhance. And so therefore there'll be a requirement to make better things, because it will just be about standing out again, but in a different way. It's kind of how I play it out. I don't know if I'm being reductive thinking in that.
I think so. The other thing I think of our beautiful industry that I love and has given me a great career and you know, I'm very passionate about still, is we're not owed anything.
No.
If this thing's going to do it better, it's going to do it better.
Yeah.
Why do we deserve to have our businesses grow and our agencies grow in this industry to grow? Why do we deserve that? You know, Weight Watchers went under this week because of, you know, weight loss jabs. You're not owed anything. This is business. The world is evolving. I think sometimes we are, again, me, and I'm sure I'm just as guilty of this as anyone else, but we can get our blinkers on and go, the creative industry is the most important thing in the world. But AI in general, and again, what I know about this is zero, but what it could do for the NHS or what it could do for healthcare or what it could do for any number of things, you go, well, if the creative industry diminishes or junior jobs in the creative industry don't get done, maybe that's a good, you know, a good outcome. I don't know.
No, I agree with you. And if that's the tax, if the tax that we have to pay to cure cancer is that the industries that we once loved and admired and meant that we could make things for, you know, whatever, that is the part that has to suffer, then so be it.
I think the key is that we don't hold on to the way we've always done things.
Yeah.
But you could apply that to any era of any development of any industry. If we hold on to, you know, the old systems and the old processes and the way it used to happen, we got to respect that. We got to understand it. If we're building our businesses around things always remaining the same, that's probably a pretty risky strategy, I'd say. Not just with AI, with absolutely anything.
Is there a lag, right? Because this point around 60% of leaders wanting to hire an AI instead of a Gen Z person, is that a sort of moment in time thing? Because at the moment, AI isn't as good. You know, it's too risky to bring a new human being in. Are we just in a bit of a weird moment? Or is this going to be a problem? And how do we navigate around that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very compelling. What I think about AI is that it touches so many things. It has so many applications. You know, when this same podcast was talking about Web3 communities and the blockchain and everything else, it's quite the, I see the outcomes of reason being, we're more limited in my opinion. And so it hasn't really had the same stat you would have reeled off to someone else talking about Web3 about what it's going to be in 2030 would have been something else, right? And so we don't really know. But I do think it could be a bit of a problem because what we're seeing now is, like you say, lots of people forgetting how they got into the industry or forgetting how it's important not just to go for efficiency. And I think that we are seeing junior jobs diminish, right? We're seeing less opportunities on our job boards for those kind of things because there is an alternative, which is quite exciting at the moment. What I don't know is whether that alternative continues to be that exciting or gets more exciting or becomes, you know, slightly stickier and there's other repercussions for it. I don't know. But you could argue definitely from, you know, our view of the industry and junior talent, that it looks like it might get trickier.
Can you just tell me a little bit about Creative Lives in Progress and what it is?
So essentially, the easiest way to think about Creative Lives in Progress is it's creative career advice, right, on a platform. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to help you, from whatever means you're from whatever background, access free information about jobs that exist in the creative industries.
Yeah.
Right. So what we're doing there, we made it on our 10th birthday, if it's nice that, because we were so bored of the youngest part of our audience coming to It's Nice That and looking at a photographer and going, is this a job?
Yeah.
Like, what is this? My tutor just tells me to, you know, if I'm lucky enough to go to university, my tutor just tells me to go and work at the studio that he worked at or she worked at. And you're like, well, that's pretty bad advice. And if I had a pound for every person who said, oh, I wish we had this, you know, I wish I had this when I was starting because I just fell into it or whatever else. So the journey from education or no education into your first thing is just not strategic at all. Really, it depends on who you know. It depends on nepotism. It depends on all those things that we're trying to dispel. So what Creative Lives is trying to do across three things, with content, with events to help you meet industry, and with pooling all the entry-level and junior opportunities in one place, we're trying to create a community of for talent who are trying to get their first steps in the industry, whether that's a career or they're starting their own thing or whatever else. We're trying to have a home and a platform that can help you get started in the industry, whether you have access to your dad works at the Tate or not. That's the key, right? But the big difference, and if I was really selling Creative Lives in Progress, I'd say that there are thousands of initiatives everywhere trying to do that.
Yeah.
There's a cohort here, there's an internship here, there's an apprenticeship here, but there isn't a community doing that.
No.
There isn't a place where emerging talent can feel seen and might apply for an opportunity. If they don't get it, they're not just them back in the ether.
Mm.
We're trying, a bit like we do with It's Nice That, right? If we did anything successfully on It's Nice That, is build a creative community and an audience that trust us and come back every day when they want inspiration, they want to find out what's going on, or you know, they want to come and see what's happening in our world. No one's doing that for emerging talent, and that's what we're trying to build. We're trying to build a safe space for emerging talent to come and be seen and get advice and find an opportunity and find a job and meet someone from industry and just be seen. And that, so not an initiative, but an always on thing that you can make use of for free, whether you get on that great initiative that agency are doing or that brilliant social enterprise are doing. If you don't get on the cohorts, well, you're not on. And I love Brixton Finching School. Amazing. I love DNAD Shift. I love New Blood. I love all the things that these are doing. But if you don't get on them, then what?
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is catch that and go, actually, if we can be a hub for all of these opportunities that exist, all of those things I just mentioned, plus information that you can get whether you get on or not, and free events, then hopefully we create a community of emerging talent that we can help in whatever way they're going to need to be helped.
What do you find is the biggest challenge for someone that is breaking into the creative industry? What stops them from getting a job?
Opportunity. Right now, opportunity.
As in there aren't enough?
Yeah, there aren't enough. There might have been a time where it was skill, or you know, they weren't technically gifted enough or whatever else. But what I see more generally is just opportunity. So, opportunity is less. So there's less internships, there's less junior positions for lots of the reasons you said, with technology for sure, but also just the economy.
Mm.
Now, in general, there's less work from clients for all of these agencies that used to exist. Mm. And, you know, cost of living is through the roof and businesses are struggling. You know, I'm sure you can find a stat on the amount of businesses that are close to going under. Yeah. You know, that I would say is almost as big, is the it's been harder commercially from what I can see over the past, definitely since, you know, 2022. It's been harder for creative companies to make ends meet.
Mm.
So I have complete sympathy. Mm. Why aren't you hiring that junior? Well, we can barely keep the lights on.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah. I get it. So it's not a slight at that. I do think the economic challenges that have happened in our industry over the past few years are as big as the technological ones.
Mm.
Definitely for the amount of opportunities that exist today, that's definitely a massive, massive, massive factor. We can't blame it on AI.
No. So there's a supply and demand problem, right? Mm-hmm. We have an oversupply potentially of creative talent and an under demand from those businesses that they would like to work at. Okay, when there is that sort of problem, I always say, well, there needs to be some kind of differentiation happening, whether it's the talent differentiating themselves to make themselves more appealing for those companies to be hired and stand out in the pool, or it's those companies differentiating from their peers and doing something brave and different, so then they become the place. Because at the end of the day, if you are in the creative industry, it isn't the tech industry, it is a talent game at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, you can survive and keep the lights on by keeping senior people within the business, you know, putting them on clients or whatever else. But eventually they will die. So you need to look after the talent coming through. So I think it's important. This is important. It's not like a nice to have. It's a necessity. The way that the businesses are running right now is not a sustainable way of running a business, right? We need to keep on bringing this talent through. So I want to kind of get quite practical. Like, I want to get into, let's focus on the businesses, actually. I want to start there. Like, what would you say to those businesses that are considering or thinking about potentially bringing a junior person into the business?
I say, be thoughtful about it and do it. Yeah, let's do it. I think lots of businesses forget how they started. You know, if I ask any of the people that I might be asking to be a supporter of Creative Lives in Progress, sometimes they forget that they had a mentor and someone introduced them to someone, or they met someone at a portfolio review, or someone replied to their internship application and said, oh, maybe not, but maybe about here. So I think there's we can't forget that this talent just needs support. They need help.
Yeah.
And so if you can create a position, great. And if you can think about what the experience might be for that person coming into your potentially hybrid working or completely remote working, or and how they're going to get the best out of it and how they might learn, that's what I'd be telling them. But I think right now it's about intent. It's about people going, yeah, I see that I have a responsibility to try and help. And that might not be hire someone.
No.
But come to one of our events, be on a panel, meet someone, say yes to that LinkedIn message and have a half an hour coffee. Yeah. Like, I'm not saying that we all need to be changing our businesses completely to be able to hire juniors, because it's just not practical. But if you forget that generation, if you forget that cohort, because it could be older people pivoting, right? But anyone looking to start in that industry, if we forget them, then what? And I think we are all here. We have a platform. We started Creative Lives in Progress because we had this huge platform with It's Nice. I'm like, well, what do we do with that?
Yeah.
Do we just make it bigger? What are we going to try and leave as a legacy in the creative industry? And this felt like something that, with our superpowers of editorial and building community and audiences, we could do something for this emerging talent. And if we move the dial 1%, 2%, we help thousands or hundreds, great. That's better than, you know, just sitting on our pedestal.
I like the idea of doing one thing. When we spoke on the phone before this call, before this podcast, you said something that I thought was so compelling. And I've now taken it on as well. And it's, you know, I'm trying to run a business. I'm trying to expand into the US and do this podcast. You know, a whole load of things, a whole load of reasons not to look at my LinkedIn messages. But you said something that I thought was really powerful. And that was, just do one thing a week. If you spot an opportunity where somebody is asking for your help, do one thing, reply to that message, have that half an hour call, write the email, connect them on to somebody else if you're not the person. And what's really weird is after our call, I had a message from a lady called Jamila Brown, who she's doing a thing for Jamal Edwards, who sadly passed away. He's got this new, it's like a self-belief sort of mentorship program. And she's asked me to help, and I straight away was like, oh my God, that's exactly what Alex is talking about. Yeah. So I want to give things like that as much of a platform as possible. Because even if I'm not the person that is the mentor, I'm so lucky to be exposed to so many people that would want to be doing that and could, you know, give half an hour or whatever it is a week.
And I think clearly something more systematic, maybe governmental level, might have to happen if we do have swathes of unemployed people because of this technology. That will be a social problem before it's an economic problem. And so I think that what I don't pretend to know that we will do one thing. Is that going to solve it? Maybe not. But from the position that I sit in, that feels like the most appropriate thing to do. Should government be funding? You know, I remember in COVID, they had the Kickstart placements where they're basically funded. And where did that go? That worked. That was great. Yeah,
Everyone paid for the apprenticeships.
Yeah, right? They just paid for, or it was subsidized. So it was really cheap for us to get someone junior in the business. And that had its own challenges, but it was also a great opportunity. I think that probably what needs to happen from a junior talent perspective, I'd love Creative Lives in Progress to be part of this solution, but we're not going to solve it. You know, I'm not going to pretend my ego is that big, but it probably needs to be something more governmental level. And you know, that I would love to meet people who are deciding those things and try and help them do their thing. But I don't have those expertise, not to diminish responsibility for that. But I do think it needs probably something bigger than Creative Lives in Progress. However, have you ever heard that parable of the starfish? I'm going to completely I'm going to murder this. But I always believed in this, this idea of, you know, and sorry for someone who actually knows what this proverb is or this parable is, but essentially a woman looks out onto a beach and she can see a figure in the distance kind of walking up and down and kind of like lobbing something. It's a bit weird. And she's like, she goes a bit closer and she can see there's starfish. They've all been washed up on the sea, on the beach. And essentially they're all dying on the sand because the tide is going out. But she still sees this figure. And so she walks closer to the figure. And the figure is literally, it's a little boy. And she realizes that he's picking up starfish and he's just lobbing them back in one by one. And she goes, what are you doing? You'll never make a difference. And he looks at the starfish. He goes, I made a difference to this one. Pops it in. And that has always been my approach to getting started on a really massive problem.
Yeah.
You can help on that one mentorship scheme. That's pretty good. Chuck it in. Or feel completely like this problem is way too big and anything you do is futile.
Yeah.
Well, then all the starfish are still on the beach. At least get one back in. Yeah. Maybe that one helps someone else. Or maybe someone sees you throwing it in and you throw. And then maybe she's throwing them in. And I just think, again, in the mindset that I like to wake up in that, you know, we'll be okay and things are going to be all right, again, maybe naive, I think that's just a better way to live. Yeah. I'd prefer to go out there after this and go and throw one starfish in than go, oh shit, the beach is full of starfish, what's going to happen?
Mm.
And be paralysed.
I think we need a huge system to change this thing.
Which we probably do. But am I in charge of that system and do I have the expertise? Maybe not. I'm not going to admit defeat. But what we've always done, especially with It's Nice That Is, we always had, you were talking about values and purpose and anything else, but, you know, this idea of enabling creativity to thrive, or now in residence, it's the same mission in different words, you know, empower creative potential.
Mm.
A lot of the work that I love doing is finding the stories of the people we've empowered or the people we've helped thrive and tell those stories and go, well, you know, if we help this one person get a job, you know, I heard on LinkedIn yesterday, we did a portfolio review as Creative Lives in Progress for one of our partners, Google, who are trying to help a cohort of 20 people get their portfolios reviewed. And one of them got a job at Google in their fellowship program, just one in LA. And I was just like, great. Yeah. That's what I need to hang on to. Yeah. Not, oh man, there's not enough jobs for all these designers. It's like, yeah, but I managed to, with this platform that we've invested 8 years in, and the thing I did, that one person's life might be changed. That's enough for me. That's plenty.
This is a lesson that you taught me once, and we were speaking about culture eats strategy for breakfast. I think
no, it was purpose eats. What was it?
Impact eats purpose for breakfast. Yeah. This is the whole like purpose is dead.
That's from Jesse Baker at Provenance. She told me that.
But you locked it in my mind by really what you're talking about is the starfish, right? Because I remember we were doing this values thing at Unknown, and I was sweating what are the five, what are the three values we're going to be? What are the principles going to be? Thinking that someone is going to memorize these things. Someone is going to think that they're as important to them as they are to me. Mm. Do I know what the 10 principles of the business are that I wrote for, 2 years ago? No, I can't even remember one. Mm-hmm. What I do remember are the little moments that we have created within the business, like, the person getting the job or whatever. And you taught me that actually is like, remind everyone daily, when you spot an artifact of the business, which is a very kind of like metaphorical term, when you spot a thing that's happened that is a demonstration that ladders up to why your company exists, it's so important to acknowledge it and say, look, that thing, by the way, is us. It's proof that what we're all doing every day is laddering up to the thing that we all really care about.
Mm.
It's funny, when you were speaking about like, what do we need for this change? I always talk about three A's, the acknowledgement, you acknowledge, and then you accept, and then you adapt. Why I think this podcast is really important is I don't know if we have acknowledged that there is a problem within this industry.
Mm.
I think that there's a conflation, a really unhealthy conflation, which is there's a talent war on. And that's true. That is true. At a senior level, there is a talent war for the top 1% of people in this industry.
Meaning what? What's a talent war?
A talent war is we need to work the hardest to get the best people into our business so we win the client.
Okay.
There is a talent war. Of course, there always will be because this is a services-based business, which means humans are giving services.
Mm-hmm.
It's rare that you'd have a technological moat around your company because they're agencies generally. Where there's not a talent war is at the junior end.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people are hearing there's a talent war, i.e. there's a huge cry out for talent to come and join the industry. But it's not, it's confusing and it's a poor conflation, because what we're saying is that at the highest end, there is a problem. There's a top 1% problem where this very unique niche talent is in demand. But at the lower end, there isn't a demand to teach that talent.
But there's also so much in the market.
Yeah, totally.
You know, there are, for every opportunity on Creative Lives in Progress, I bet there's hundreds and thousands of applicants.
Yeah.
And so also, that's also putting people off advertising them, because,
totally.
Oh man, I can't sift through them.
No.
And I think that what's also important, it isn't a nice thing to do. It is. And socially, you should feel motivated to do something that's socially good as well as commercially good.
Mm.
But we always have to bring back to commercial value. What's the commercial value of bringing that junior in? And the thing that I see that's a challenge there is short term, maybe nothing. That's hard. Lots of people work on 12-month P&Ls, 6-monthly target, quarterly targets. So it is pretty hard to probably now, with the state of some of the P&Ls, to make a case for that junior because actually in the short term, it's not going to do anything. Whereas longer term, midterm, if you're looking at 3 years, 5 years, you might go, wow, we could bring some of our own through this, and we don't have to pay, you know, to headhunt the person that really needs talent. Maybe we could build with them. But it takes a long-term view, and that's hard. That's hard when the economy as it is and business is struggling and whatever else. But I'm a big football fan, right? And the other thing that I think of is sometimes when I'm, you know, grappling with these kind of industry-led, quite blinkered problems, I go, well, how's everyone else doing it? I go, well, if you don't have an academy at Man United, Rashford never gets made, and, you know, he doesn't develop his skills, and then you have to buy that striker for hundreds of millions rather than have him in your squad, right? That's basic. It's slightly different because these are assets for these clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if, you know, we owned junior talent and they were assets,
yeah,
and actually
true.
You could sell them to another agency, maybe it would be different, right?
Yeah.
But there is just something fundamental. The fact that we have to explain why it's good business to bring new ideas in and new talent in feels futile to me. If we're having to explain the commercial imperative of having new ideas and fresh blood and new talent in your organisation, then we're finished.
What if we work back from something? Like, I like the idea of this 3-year journey, right? I'm sure you can draw a revenue stream to somebody's head after 3 years of existence within a business. What if you said, like, this is a journey to get you commercially viable? And you say, right, this is going to be, we're going to be, I don't know, in private equity, they talk about 200 weeks. I cut my maths, like, isn't great. 52, 104, let's call it the 104 week journey to value.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, that, you know, then you have this breakdownable essence to, okay, I've got 104 weeks in this business to get myself and to listen and to learn and to figure out how I can be commercially contributionary to this business. Because I think that's the other thing we don't really speak about. An unhealthy conflation is that junior is charity, or like bringing juniors is a charitable, which is not true. It's a commercial choice, and it can have commercial value if you just spent some time figuring out how somebody can quickly get to contributing commercial value to your business. If there's one thing that, you know, when I speak to junior people, I always say is, like, figure out the money bit. Like, I know you want to work. And like you said, you know, the world doesn't owe you anything here. Capitalism is a very, very efficient beast. And if you figure out how money flows within an agency or a brand and how your, you know, work can contribute to that number increasing, you're head and shoulders above everybody else.
I couldn't agree more. I think it does come down to making more money. And then if you have a supply and demand problem, it doesn't matter how many great juniors you have. If the work isn't there for anyone, I think that therein lies the challenge. But it's a really, really fascinating time. I think with my socially minded hat on, business hat on, I feel like it's sad that it all has to be, you know, return on that. I went to, and I love Creative Equals, I think do the most incredible work with diverse talent of all levels, probably more senior actually than at junior levels. But, you know, I went to their conference and it was about, you know, the return on diversity and inclusivity. And I'm like, it's just so sad. I get it. And it's smart. It's an important, maybe that is how we have to proposition it to the C-suite. I get that. I'm not denying it. And I think it's super smart, but I don't know, just a bit of my soul dies with that stuff. I'm like, oh, we have to explain. I get it. But I don't know. It's not my natural place. And I think that to solve the coming challenge that might happen. It's going to need lots and lots and lots of different minds, not just me or Creative Lives in Progress. Yeah. But what I want to be able to do with Creative Lives in Progress is when the system needs changing or we have to procure something to this emerging talent, like, I don't know, pool, that we're there for that. So when the government go, hey, we've got a new kickstart scheme, great, well, we've got 200,000 emerging talent right here. Or when we've got to retrain them all to work in climate because the world's underwater, well, we've got a load of smart, talented, creative problem solvers here. What do we procure to them? And so we're trying to build, again, when I say it's not initiatives, we're trying to build a community that we can give them different content if we want. Right now we're talking about creative careers. We could give them something else. We could give them different events to meet other industries if we needed to. Yeah. We could give them different opportunities. But the buckets of what we're doing or the structure and the foundations of what we're doing, I hope can adapt from, you know, 2025 to 2030 to 2035 to make a difference, to chuck some starfish in the sea.
If let's just say the economy was thriving and this industry was kicking off, right?
Yeah.
And a kid comes to you and says, I want to do what you've done, but I want to get there in half the time.
Yeah.
I quite like this idea. What would you put an 18-year-old through to get to where you are in half the time?
I'd ask them why they want to do it so quickly. What's the point? I don't know. There's just I think that's madness. I think it's experience, and we were given the opportunity to you know, university wasn't that expensive for me.
Mm-mm.
It was £9,000. And we could get an office on Rivington Street in Shoreditch on Gumtree. You know, these are completely different times. We could start, our website cost us a couple of £1,000 at the beginning, you know. So actually, I think now probably the barriers to entry, especially with all the AI changes, are great. I'd say get started. Mm. I think you've got to get started. I think we've learned so much from experience. We've done it very slowly. So actually doing it half the time probably isn't that bad. This is our 18th year of doing this, right? And so I would urge them to try and get experience, try and see how other people are doing it and to try new ways of doing it yourself. But I'd be in and around people who have already trodden those journeys.
Mm.
I'd be having them beg to come in and work with us, with our teams for a week, for a month or whatever else. And so, I don't know, if I had my time again, I would have, we definitely could have done it quicker if we'd gone and worked at some other publishing companies or some other media companies or some other agencies or some other jobs boards or recruiters, you know. But we were so naive, we just did it the way we did it, which makes something very unique. But, you know, some people would look at our growth and go, oh my God, that's the slowest thing I've ever seen. But in community, that builds loyalty and it builds trust. And we've turned up every day for 18 years. And so that builds something different. Does it build loads of shareholder value in EBIT? No. Does it build a very loyal, engaged community? 100%.
It does seem like that is the future. Like, I know everyone's been saying community is the future for a while now, but like, if you think about how brands are reaching their audiences now, it's not TV broadcast. It's not like paid ads on Instagram. They're saying it's the fans of the of the influencers, right? The people that are really the communities of these of the influencers and the brands. A lot of new product development is now happening within community. Do you think that there are going to be lots of, I guess, people coming in to imitate what you've done? Or can you imagine a world where there's another It's Nice That that, you know, appeals to a similar audience?
I'm sure. I mean, I think you wouldn't build It's Nice That if you were starting today. You'd be doing that on other platforms. And you'd be building a website. You'd probably be building an Instagram or a TikTok or something else. Just like when we started in 2007, you wouldn't be building a printed magazine. You'd be building it on WordPress like we did. And that would have been alien. That would have been like, what? They're doing it on the internet? And so, I don't know. I embrace all of that stuff. And yeah, I'm sure there'd be loads of competition, but that's, I think it's really helpful. It's really positive for us to have, you know, people trying to imitate what It's Nice That are doing or something else. But again, the things that get imitated are things that, you know, do double digit growth and sell for hundreds of millions of quid. And we've done fine, but it's not been that.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't know anyone's desperate to imitate a niche media platform, but maybe they are, who knows?
They say community doesn't pay, but like it's the product of, or the byproduct of what community creates, right?
Mm.
I mean, you essentially could sell your business based on the fact that you had this incredible community of and following, right? So it's weird. It's hard to monetize in itself, but it also can help you build other things or products or whatever it is around the community. I want to ask three last questions because I'm keen to make sure we have like a practical thing here.
Yeah.
One of them actually is more like the future of Creative Lives in Progress. 2 years from now, and we're sat here again.
Yeah.
What are you saying? What are you proud of and what's different?
I'm proud of the same things I'm probably proud of now, which is helping talent find their first steps and get jobs and get opportunities. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be proud of exactly the same thing. Like 18 years on from It's Nice That, I'm proud when we write about someone and they get this huge platform and then they get the job of their lives or they get notoriety like they never had or they get on something else, you know. So I think I'll be proud of exactly the same stuff. My hope is that we can find a way in this shifting sands of the moral implication of not doing stuff for junior and entry level. I hope that that lands.
Yeah.
In the same way it was so clear of the, you know, how what a terrible state the industry was in and still is in from a DEI perspective in 2020. I hope the same penny drops of like, oh, we have got to do something. And I'd hope Creative Lives in Progress can make that really easy for someone who wants to help for a few hundred or thousand pounds a year, just help us be involved in our things and we can help you get in front of this audience. And so if you can't hire, it doesn't matter. Still get involved, become a partner and come to our events, give back, meet some people, learn something from this generation. And so my hope is that we've managed to convince more people to see the upside and the excitement about helping emerging junior talent, both here in the UK and in the second half of this year, we're launching Creative Lives in the US. I'm hoping we're doing that in, you know, a couple of different markets.
Okay. You kind of answered my second question, which was going to be, if you have one thing to say to a business right now, what would that one thing be?
Yeah, don't do nothing. Don't do nothing. But also don't try and do everything. Mm. You have bigger priorities. I get it. I've run a business for 18 years. This is not always top. But to sit there and do nothing is no great long-term strategy. Yeah. And it will still be the same challenge for you in 12 months if you do nothing. Come, email me, let's throw one starfish in. That's it. Just throw a starfish in with us. But you don't even have to find the starfish. We'll find the starfish. We'll find the beach. All you have to do is just, you know, you just have to point us to the beach. You know, that's it. We want to be a conduit, not only for our community, but also for industry to meet in the middle, to that Venn diagram.
Okay, and then my last, before I go to my closing question, is if you had, you know, the room full of 18, whatever, new cohort coming into the creative industry, what one thing can they do or what one thing would you say to them?
Get really interested and curious in what the future of this industry might be. If you really want to work in it, I'd be using all the tools that are out there and I would get an abundant mindset on and get excited, you know. I met one of the interviews that stuck with me, I've spoken about this so many times, but one of the interviews that really stuck with me from our time of interviewing lots of amazing creatives over the years is Nick Knight, the photographer, you know, who's an old school, brilliant film photographer when I met him and was so excited about fashion film. He's the first person doing fashion film as a established creative who I expected to go, only shoot on film, this is just the way it's done. You know, I am the artist, this is how it's done. And at every single stage of his career, he's embraced whatever's next, even as someone who's completely established, the same as Paul Smith. Or I get so inspired by people, despite what they've done, or their notoriety, or their status, are excited about the next thing, or are not trying to protect their thing, their lot. They're curious. And that, if you can get that mindset as a 18-year-old in any industry, I think, or as just someone pivoting, forget age. I think that is the biggest gift you can have, is an excitement for what's next. Because if you are excited about it and you're interested in it and you're learning it, there will be a place for you.
Yeah. Wow. And my last question, which I kind of...
How many last questions have you had?
This is my last one. This is my last closing question. This is about giving a platform to someone. This probably is quite a hard one for you to answer. So if you haven't already thought about it, your brain's going to be whirring. Our closing tradition is to ask you to use this as a platform to tell the world about someone that you think everyone should know about. So who in the world, which one person, last time they did three, so ideally you'd stick to one, do you think the world should know about?
I think it's a very, very tricky one. Again, I don't want this to be too navel-gazy, but...
Me?
I think... No, I'm really not. As you know, I'm not that interested in that at all, actually. I'd much prefer to sink into the background. But I think as we try and grow Creative Lives and Progress in the US, we have this fantastic person internally called Roshana Bagley, who started a community called Where Are the Black Designers? Is a big part of that with her partner Mitzi. And they are doing so much for emerging talent. She's a great community builder. And she's in charge of helping us turn up in the US for the first time. So if you don't know Roshana... you don't know her work, you don't know what she's doing for Clip, that's who I want you to know, because I want you to get involved in what we're trying to build at Creative Lives and Progress in the US and in the UK. So I'll go, sorry, it's probably a bit promotion-y, but Roshana, yeah.
That's perfect.
And sorry for everyone else who also does a brilliant job for Clip and all of our other businesses, but
you
I guess
can't name them.
That is the thing that's on the top of my mind for the second half of the year is how do we continue to make more impact through Creative Lives and Progress, and I think the US will be a big part of that.
For sure. Alex Beck, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're a legend.
Oh, thank you, sir.